They don't understand the act. And I think that the capabilities of the Native leadership or the Native people in general, I have a feeling that every one of them knows the direction that we needed to take or what they really wanted in the terms of a settlement. I think that for a period of time we were totally misguided by legal advice and other consulting advice. I think that, again, we're falling into the same trap. We have people that are speaking on our behalf that have never taken the time to talk to the total body of the Native people to find out their true feelings, what they really like to see happen. We have a group that's pushing, and it's a pet peeve to me, they're pushing the 1991 issues. It's another fear tactic. It's a smokescreen for some reason I don't really know. It's and I'm speaking to the Alaska Federation of Natives. I've taken the time to do research on the makeup of that organization. I find that a village corporation could be associate member, but they have no vote. There's, I believe that in the Southeast region, the Sea Alaska region, or Tlingit Haida region, they have 80-some delegates, of which none that I know of attended last year's annual convention. I've done a personal poll of 7 regional corporations to ask what their opinion or feelings were on the 1991 issue. The top management didn't understand what I was asking. They didn't know what I was talking about. And I feel that, you know, we're grossly being misrepresented in an area that could have a severe financial impact on the existing, or as the, on the corporations as they now exist. I think that it's history repeating itself because they're not really listening to the people that they are supposed to be responsible to. I just have that could be my personal feeling. I'm not really. I'm speaking just in general for myself. I have so many problems with interpretation of the act myself, and I feel that I have a pretty fair working knowledge of the act. I'll probably think of something later. But thank you.
Thanks, Mr. Thompson.
My name is Rosemary Wilson, and I'm also a member of Kivoko Incorporated. As I look around, I seem to see that the majority of the people sitting in here are from Kivoko. I feel as Lewis does that a lot of the people don't understand the ANSCA Act or the ANILCA Amendment, and that the people should be more informed in, maybe I shouldn't say simple language, because I certainly don't feel that our people are simple, but I feel that it should be transcribed perhaps in a simpler way to where people would be able to understand exactly what the act is, the amendments, and what the individual corporations can do about it. I feel that the average shareholder is really not aware of these things unless they are on a board to where they are given access to this information. I feel that leadership in a corporation is very important. We were very fortunate in Kivoko of having the leadership to take us where we're at now. I know that there's a lot of corporations that are having a lot of trouble, and we all feel badly about it, but there doesn't seem to be an answer to the problem. There's a lot of people saying different things of different ideas on what to do, but we never do come up with a solution. I believe that the responsibility of the afterborn and the elderly and that particular problem should be taken care of on an individual basis. I have in my own family two sisters who were born in Kasan that they were not informed at the enrollment that if they were not living in the village, they were told that they were not be able to sign up with Kasan. As a result, they were not enrolled. My mother was another one that was not. I feel that the people should have been more informed at the time of the enrollment because there was a lot of people that were left out. I was in a drugstore yesterday and I saw an old lady that I hadn't seen for several years, and she asked me where I lived now, and I told her I had just recently moved back to Kasan. And she said that at one time her grandfather lived in Kasan, and she said she felt like coming there to confront Kavilko because she was not enrolled. I know there's so much confusion. Like I say, she is an older person, and there's a lot of people that kind of blame the corporations that they belong to because they were misinformed by the enumerators. I don't know what else to say. I'm pretty nervous. I just wanted to get up and say, you know, that I really do feel that I think if the people were more informed about the act and the amendments to the act, that if they had a better understanding about it, you would probably have a lot more speakers up here to come up with maybe better solution to our problems. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Wilson.
I wish there were more Sean Seat members here. I'm having a hard time keeping up with Kavilko. Craig is comprised of probably 50% Tlingits and 50% Haidas. The Tlingits weren't successful in running out the Haidas. We got to live with them. It was for Estelle's benefit. I think as we look at the issues and topics leading up to 1991, I think it becomes apparent that there needs to be some work done to rectify some of the problems of the past. I think one of the issues that comes to mind is that of the elderly being excluded from direct benefits from the Claims Settlement Act. And I think, at least from my point of view, and I'm sure it's one that's not universally accepted by officials in all corporations, but I feel that there should have been some provisions to amend or make at least provisions to provide for elderly people to get direct benefits, monetary or other health or other benefits that would eliminate the necessity of them to become wards of the state through welfare programs, etc. I think there are ways to do that. As we look at the corporate structure and what it is and the laws that were there prior to the formation of the Alaska Native Claims Act, I think people can understand the idea that you have to treat all share owners equally. And I think that that law in itself has a purpose. But I think you have laws and then you have the truth. The truth of the matter is that those people that work so hard to make the situation a reality are now excluded because their life is ending shortly and they have not received any direct benefits. And I think there's ways in which we can amend laws. We've done it since this country was formed. And I still think that there is room to make provisional amendments to allow for benefit to elders without destroying the intent of the act. Also, in our regional corporation, I think there was mention made of the fact that resources of the corporation are utilized for the election of board members, and they understand that that's universally accepted in all corporate societies and entities. However, it must be kept in mind also that in the election process that we are confronted with, our corporation is one of the quasi-corporation election process due to the fact that each person has one vote like a democratic entity rather than a corporate entity where the board of directors control the votes because they own most of the stock. So I think there's a vast difference there, and I think that to utilize one standard to benefit a few is not in keeping with the intent of having everybody equal on one hand as far as rights, and then on the other hand not so equal when it comes to the selection of the governance or the selection of the board. I don't think it's rectifiable at this time. However, I just bring that out for the record that probably there could have been provisions made until 1991 to allow for a democratic process and to allow the leadership to take a natural course of election through their own records rather than through the utilization of resources early in the game so that there is no opportunity to identify the people that would best run the corporation from then on. So I think that there should have been those kinds of limitations to eliminate some of the problems that we're confronted with right now. After 1991, where there can be a trading, selling, and buying of stocks, then I think the utilization of resources to solicit proxies for quorum purposes would be in order. Getting back to the Village Corporation of Craig and Sean Seat Incorporated, we, like Kassan, are quite proud of our record. We have done a number of things that I think that are in line with good business. We did not sell our first timber sale in a stumpage sale like Kavilko did. We should have. Everybody knows that now, but we didn't know then. However, our management plan has been one, I think, that is conservative, yet we're trying to get involved in the process ourselves all the way from the cutting to the marketing. We are going to be, this upcoming year, operating our own sort yard. We have purchased a hotel in Juneau, and we built one in Craig, as well as a restaurant and lounge, and we own two office buildings in Craig. We have two trailer parks, and we are the first village corporation in southeastern Alaska to give 1.5 acres to each of our share owners through a lottery program. And I might add that I feel that that program is very successful and people are very pleased with it. I think that those kinds of things, on one hand, we're trying to blend good business sense with the need to provide direct benefits to share owners so that they can benefit from the Claims Act in a more tangible way. When we try to keep things fair and open, I think we find that oftentimes we run into a lot of restrictions. We have tried to develop a scholarship program for young people, and we find that even doing a simple thing like that is quite expensive because of the laws that govern those kinds of things. We've done it anyway, but it's a learning process for all of us, and I wish that there was some standards that could be set up by people that have done it in the past so that they can share it with us so we don't have to do all this stuff over again. I think there should be an archive set up for people to go to find resource materials or to see how somebody else did it so they don't have to do it again. I might add that Sean Seed is making available to anybody who wants to disseminate land to the share owners the information that we utilized in doing that process. After studying the distribution program under ANILCA, we backed off and decided to do it under a liquidation of assets due to the fact that corporate entities that are not in a profit-making vein, and most corporations aren't, because when the Basin Girard's study was done, the value of the timber was at its peak, so now the depletion outweighs the actual price you're getting for the timber, so therefore most of us are operating in a negative or in a loss situation. Therefore, liquidation of assets back to the share owner of some land does not become a profit gains to the share owner. And we can reserve the rights under ANILCA for a future date when we may want to disseminate lands within a taxable jurisdiction, such as the city of Craig, where we do so own some land. So I think those are some ideas I'd like to share with people, because I think they are important, because you can only use the provisions of ANILCA once in each corporation. There is, I think, a lot of good things that are happening to people in our area as a result of the timber just being harvested. I think we've seen just about every share owner that wants to work either in the longshoring or working in the mill operated by Ed Head or the Alaska Timber Corporation. So I think the logging in the area has created a stronger economy base for our share owners in our area. Not all share owners are capable of working or really want to in our enterprises, however, most of those that want to have been able to. So I think that's been very positive. If we were to try to structure something that would be of significance in preserving native lands to native ownership, in 1991, I think we need to look at the reasons people are wanting to transfer land from a village corporation to trust status. And I think one of them is to avoid taxes. I don't think we have to go that far. I think you can amend taxing laws, you can amend this law to say that the lands that were selected by the natives would not be taxable. I think you can amend that law much easier than you can fighting with the issue of trust status, and I think it would serve the same purpose. And then those lands that are commercially used for warehousing for other businesses then could become taxable as any other property. But private lands that have been logged and are of no commercial value, again, I think they should just simply amend the law to eliminate them from the rolls of taxes. Because I think there is a potential, as you mentioned in your radio show, that if the state runs into a negative cash flow as a result of the declining revenues from the oil fields, I think we're going to find that they may be interested in taxing private lands for the purpose of running their government. And so I think it's time now to amend the law to just say that these lands are not going to be taxable unless they're used on an ongoing basis for commercial uses. That's my feeling on the impacts of 1991.
Could I ask you a question about the distribution of land by lottery to shareholders by your village corporation? Mr. Thompson said that his corporation was doing it under ANILCA, which allows 1.5 acres to be distributed to each shareholder. And I think it has to be for a home site or something like that. You said that you're not using ANILCA, but doing it as liquidation of assets and by lottery. Do you charge the shareholders who win the lottery for the land a nominal sum, or does the shareholder get it without charge?
It's all without charge. We did all the surveying with the general corporation assets, and we did all the staking of the corners, monuments, I guess they call them.
Well, what is the land to be used for? How large are the parcels of land, and what would the shareholders likely be using them for?
We use the provisions of ANILCA or the guidelines of ANILCA to determine the size, and in the event we had to use ANILCA. So if we were forced into because of other laws, we would go ahead and use ANILCA.
So you've covered your tracks, so to speak. Mm-hmm. So they're 1.5 acres. Under the lottery, how many lots will be distributed? Could you tell me that?
Yeah, we have 330 share owners, so we developed about 340 lots, and we did it with initial lottery, and then we had a 120-day trading period, which share owners could trade, and then we have another 60 days in which we're going to develop the paperwork, and then we're going to issue the deeds after the 60 days. So you got about, how many days is that? About 100 days. Mm-hmm. Oh, no, 280 days. No, 180 days.
Well, whatever.
Yeah.
So that every shareholder will wind up with a 1.5 acre lot.
Yeah. Not every share owner, I shouldn't say that. Every share owner of record, the deceased that divide up their land or will it to numerous of their family will end up as one estate.
Well, let me put it this way. For every 100 shares, there's one lot. Is that it?
Yeah. Outstanding
and
shares.
Yes. And where someone has died and willed his shares to two persons so that each person has 50 shares, they get one lot between them.
Right.
I follow you.
The lottery process was, I thought, pretty well accepted. I think there were those that did not get the land they wanted, but we were fortunate that most of our lands were fairly close to equal in value and appearance, and all shoreline property that was not going to be utilized anyway, because you have to have on the waterfront at least 25-foot buffer strip between your logging areas and those things. But our properties went in about 100 feet or 200 feet maybe 150. Anyway, I think something that worked well for Shaanxi. The liquidation of assets might not work for Kavilko because they're too rich, but it worked for us. Just kidding.
For the record.
For the record. But it works well now because of the low timber market values, I should say, of the timber versus what they were appraised at, because now we're all in a negative. And if we're not showing a profit, we can liquidate the assets to the share owners without creating a tax burden to the share owners through that transfer. However, if they sold it, they would become taxable, became a capital gains.
Thank you.
My name is Louis Jones. I hold 100 shares of Sea Alaska stock and 100 shares of Kavilko stock. And a couple of thoughts that I'd like to share is basically the concept of the for-profit corporations that was so confusing to our people, in that those people that own shares of stock, say in the New York Stock Exchange, all have a surplus of assets. They had to have a place to invest this money, which has never been a luxury of our people, to have to worry about what to do with an excess of, say, $12,000, $14,000, $18,000, $20,000, $30,000, or what have you. So when that concept was presented, I think it was pretty confusing. Even to this day, among the 76,000 shareholders of Alaska Native stock, probably very few would be able to pick up a copy of the newspaper and be able to decipher, the information that is available on the listing of the New York Stock Exchange. And that idea as to what you can do with stocks, how you go about voting members onto the board of directors were all, you know, so new and so confusing at that point in time, and I think maybe it still is. In that respect, I think it was hard for most of the people that have to deal with that. Consequently, when you get into ownerships of shares of stock and what they anticipated, we've heard that a number of times as to what people expected. Even the numbers that you heard in, say, 1971, the big number was nearly $1 billion, and that translated into rich. All we had to do was sit back and wait and get our fair share. And I doubt that very many people took that nearly $1 billion and divided it up by, you know, the 76,000 natives that were qualified at that time. And if my math doesn't fail me, it translates to something about $12,000 per capita. You take the asset values of the lands, and even if you multiply that by 10, you know, you'd come up with something like $120,000 of value, hardly enough to put yourself in easy street. Again, if our people were given, say, a dollar value equal to that, very, very few would have put that into stocks for other people to manage because they had other needs, and I think they still have these other needs. So in 1991, what I would like to see happen to our people is to get themselves in the position that I am in now and was in 1971, whereas if the Land Claims Settlement Act had never come to pass, I would still be the same person. I would still have the same job that I have today, and my children born before and after 1971 are still going to be the same children. They're still going to be mine. And if our people prepare themselves in 1991, hopefully, you know, it should not be an issue. I think, as Louis pointed out, you know, he won't sell his stock because he won't need to. Those people that sell it will be those that feel that they are not getting anything in return, and they have a chance to capitalize and pick up a few dollars and do with it as they see fit and not have to rely on someone else's judgment to determine what is best for their value and the value of the stocks. And any restrictions that you put on the stocks now are going to have an effect on the value of that stock in 1991. And that concept, again, of the for-profit corporations, I think is in a situation where Kvilka was a little luckier than most in that we were able to separate the for-profit corporation concept from those other benefits that most of the people thought they should receive from corporations. And you know, the list is almost endless as to what the people expected from the Alaska Land Claims Settlement Act. But first of all, I think they probably expected a lot more money, which was supposed to solve a lot of problems. And I'm sure you all recognize that money does not solve any more problems than it creates. And you hear a lot about the land, culture, and identity. And I submit that when the Europeans came to this country, the only thing they brought was their identity. And I think our identity has got to come from within. If we rely on someone like a share of stock for our identity, you know, I think we're going to have problems. And this is the idea that, you know, I'd like to share. Well, I think there's some other comments I'd like to save for later because they're not really coming into focus right now. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to say something this evening. It's This is the second evening of hearings of the Alaska Native Review Commission, and it's to offer Alaska Natives and Alaskans generally an opportunity to state their views on the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act of 1971, the impact it has had. It's also to offer them an opportunity to speak on these issues that arise in 1991 relating to transferability of shares, taxation of land, and to deal with the issues that have come up at these meetings that we've been holding all over the state. I made a long introduction last night to the work of the commission, so I don't want to repeat it. We had quite a few people speak last night, and if you wish to speak, just feel free to come up here, sitting beside me, and just speak informally here. The evidence that everybody gives will be taken down and recorded on tape and then typed up. So there'll be a permanent record of what is said. And as I said yesterday, the report that I write will be based on what people say at these meetings. It's intended to provide the means to enable Alaska Natives to render their verdict on ANCSA and to give, to offer the basis for working out the whole question, where do Alaska Natives want to go from here. It's also intended to give guidance to Native people and governments in other countries who want to know how ANCSA has worked out and what Alaska Natives think of ANCSA and what their view is now about the next stage, so to speak. So having said that, I welcome anyone who's here tonight and who wishes to speak, and please feel free to come forward.
Well, we're here this afternoon, and most of the people, or all the people that are here now, made their presentation this afternoon, so feel free to come on up.
As some people who were here last night, we're here again this afternoon, and they've had an opportunity to speak, and so feel free to come forward tonight. There's no Yes, sir.
My name is Sandy Griffith, and I have quite a mixed ancestry, and there's all indications that the traces go in all directions. So I'm speaking only as an individual. I've been in Alaska since 1946, and I'm addressing this thing of land management and people management as an artistic problem rather than an ethnic problem, and perhaps you can read into it ethnic ideas that have more meaning than perhaps ideas that a direct approach might not assess or might be repetitive. I unfortunately have not heard the testimony of earlier participants, and I would like to hear it later, but perhaps there's an advantage in that I will be speaking purely from my own creative impressions rather than embellishing someone else's. I'm very concerned with two aspects of land development and people development. One is what I call exploitive development, which is all I've seen so far in Alaska. With the exception of all villages where the people have remained fairly close to the land and to their activities with a minimum manipulation from outside forces, and that's not very common, but I am aware that there are a few villages in the southern Kuskokwim and southwestern Alaska that have minimal influences from outside manipulators, if I can use that word, or management operators. Well, the opposite concept of exploitative development would be creative development. Now, in the my impression of the old traditional tribal societies is that there would be creative development, but it tended to level off periodically into almost ritualistic or ceremonial living, and so creative license was not encouraged beyond the point of traditional acceptable license, and if it was accepted, it became traditional accepted lifestyle. And right now I see the impact of several forces on creative development for Alaska lands and peoples threaten, quite apart from the exploitative development of Alaskan, or I should say polar lands and regions in North America. I'd rather prefer the broad general idea of Greenland and Canada and Alaska as a kind of geophysical unity, as a polar region that we might be addressing now. The direction that I feel that is rather unique is the extreme variations in climate that are taking place and the extreme escalation of political, strident political, confrontatory political activity worldwide. I think we are most fortunate in North America that above the Mexican border we do not have the kind of destructive dichotomies of political systems that are taking place south of the border and in Europe and Asia to a large degree. I hope we can stay that way. I think we can, but I think we only can if we stay close to the land, close to the soil, close to the seasons, and close to the idea of what viable growth is all about, and stay away from ideologies that are so destructive and destructive in a variety of ways, in that they emphasize confrontatory differences rather than the harmonious differences that creative identity and creative development are all about. I think all of us should be very much aware that the formalities of traditional tribal lifestyles, as I see it, now, if you don't agree with the way I see it, that's fine. I don't expect agreement, and I welcome disagreement, providing hostility is curbed. The traditional lifestyle took its symbolism from nature. The corporate lifestyle and the commercial lifestyle of the world around traditional and tribal lifestyles take their symbolism from perhaps fertility symbols for sure, but for mass appeal, mass selling, and high emphasis on sexuality and gross food consumption. And I consider it totally exploitive and non-creative. And I think that the most important thing we have to learn north of the Mexican border and west to the Diomede Island and east to the east coast of Greenland as a geophysical entity or identity, that people have to be close to the configurations of growth, real growth, not growth based on cash flow. I think the most horrendous madness in the world today are all the systems of government and all the peoples that are uprooted from, well, I was going to say subsistence living, and it's good, but I would like to use a broader term, going around in the dark for the one I'd like to use, as opposed to being totally dependent on cash flow systems of growth development. And the sad thing of cultures that tend to urbanize progressively and become electronically more and more complex is that you become progressively isolated from viable identities with plant and animal kingdoms. And I like the word kingdom used in only that context. I don't like the charismatic use of the word kingdoms that adult humanoid societies will cultivate in development. I'm not opposed to it, I just don't like it. But the idea of the plant and animal kingdom as the baseline for a viable planet makes much more sense to me than the figures of corporate growth or city growth or industrial growth or conspiratorial growth of different political systems, ideological growth of different sociological systems. I think they're all sick, but they're sick in a way that medicine wouldn't define sick. They're sick in that they have withdrawn from what might be called a natural internal factor that makes us viable identities and entities as human beings, and that when we lose soul, to use the cliched word of the hippie era, when we lose soul, we invariably have no soul, or really gain a soul we don't need, let alone want. And I think most of us are gaining souls we don't need and don't want, or feel nothing, no soul at all, which is to be brainwashed and wiped out. And you might be eating well and living well and looking well and all the things that are externalized as manifestations of growth and good health, but you could be intrinsically sick as a dog and doomed to die young with no feelings of remorse, just a good riddance to bad rubbish and glad to be done with it. And we've got a lot of that. I heard the comment earlier on the radio that it's not what the land, what you do for the land, it's what the land does for you that counts. I quite agree with that. But with the change of climate that we have today, I think we have to address two new approaches to the land using some old phraseology. There's the word intensive growth and extensive growth. In Asia, agriculture is considered intensive development, small families and small farms maximizing the productivity of the land. That's very good. That's intensive, and usually it's totally organic. The water buffalo provides the labor needed to cultivate the rice paddies, provides food and sustenance for the families, provides the hooves of the water buffalo actually act like a plow in a rice paddy, breaking up the muck and providing a mixing factor which tractors don't provide. In every aspect, perhaps the water buffalo is the most important animal on earth today, if the size of human population is more important than the quality of lifestyle, which I believe in, not the size of human population. Man can turn into an insect or a rodent by overpopulation, and when he turns into an insect or a rodent, values go down the tube. We don't really have values when we think of insects and rodents, but I call it the locust lemming effect. And unfortunately, man is slipping more and more into a locust lemming effect. And we should make every effort to realize that the largest plants in the plant system are trees. That every time you replace a tree with something else less worthy, you are also reducing your life qualitatively into something less worthy. This, of course, is my opinion. and that there is no edifice on earth today better than a mature tree, cut or uncut, preferably uncut unless it's reaching a point of aging where it's preferable to utilize the wood and allow a younger tree to take its place. But the idea of selective forestry management is not a high priority in most of the world. Clear cutting is just a practice of getting all you can in the shortest interval of time, all over the earth. And until we have a logical sense of selective forestry management and intensive gardening, I don't call it farming, I call it gardening. Gardening is a smaller term, which means more people get involved and people learn to utilize space more effectively by maximizing what space they have instead of utilizing the opposite approach which we practice in America, which is called extensive farming. And it's done with the biggest and the heaviest equipment around, and it does all kinds of bizarre things to the soil, right along with the pesticides and herbicides and the artificial fertilizers. We literally throw away all the intelligence of the past in one fell swoop to maximize profits. We just go head over heels full bore for $200,000-$400,000 farms, create enormous surpluses, embrace monoculture. You raise only one thing if you're that kind of farmer. You raise maybe wheat, maybe barley, maybe sorghum, maybe soybeans, but you become a monoculturalist. You're not a gardener. You might be a farmer. I doubt whether you're even that. You might be a factory farmer, whatever that is. But it's a total divorcement of the relationship of man and soul and the growth of plant life as a support industry. And we have to get back to the concept of plant life as a support industry, but we don't all have to be croppers. It's totally conceivable to me that we could have domesticated deer ranches all over Alaska, goat ranches, rabbit, duck, geese. These are all small farm animals, or can be. The deer are raised domestically in several parts of the world quite successfully. And it reduces the pressure on the wilderness area to have alternative ways of utilizing wilderness animals in semi-controlled environments. I saw a picture the other night of petroleum gas development in northern Alberta and Manitoba in Canada. And the thing that struck me most was that there was a very ancient Indian community that was being displaced from its conventional habits of hunting and trapping and fishing because of the roads patterns in there. And the heavy equipment and the human activity was driving all the game out if it wasn't being killed on the spot. But if all that land had been pre-planned and fenced in a fashion that the female of the species, whether they happen to be moose or caribou or some form of deer, were protected and allowed to browse, graze the land, they could allow the males to go in during to the periods when they and literally have small farms of native animals that eventually would be freed when they overcrowded the little pens between the roads that had been cut through or slashed through the brush, when they could be abandoned, when the petroleum interests moved out of the area. All these little stock areas could release their game back into a wild state. And I think it behooves us to realize that there's a difference between being domesticated and being tamed. And I don't think we should ever be maybe domesticated and only tamed a little bit, which means you should keep your spirit and your ideas very much alive, no matter what kind of powers try and change you, the way you look, the way you see, and the way you feel, and especially what you think. And And if you don't see something in your imagination that suggests that something is growing, whether it's a small deer farm or a goose, duck, chicken, or anything that will grow off of a semi-wilderness environment, you've missed something very important. Because for a long time, the only people on the earth that were anybody were people who could make a balance between the total wilderness environment and the semi-wilderness environment. I didn't say semi-domesticated environment. I said the semi-wilderness environment. And the most important thing, until the pressure of numbers overwhelms us, is to keep our concept of what a semi-wilderness environment is all about. And it really interests me that the growth of Israel was totally dependent on kibbutz. And a kibbutz is a communal society of people who literally tried to bring back a semi-wilderness relationship between man and the natural environment by artificial means, totally artificial, very, very strict laws on how a kibbutz is set up. But the idea of balanced communalism makes a lot of sense to me, and I know there are people who are offended by that word. But all the tribal cultures basically weighed the importance of ownership against communal use and environmental management of goods and resources. So the word should not be taboo, and it should not be mixed up with tough state bureaucracies like communism of Russia or China. It shouldn't have any inference of tough state bureaucracies, because I'm not talking about tough state bureaucracies, whether they're communist or capitalist or any other persuasion. I'm talking about small, easy-managed communal societies that can communicate what they're all about, what they want, what they expect, and stay away from the hard pressure of tight corporate markets and tight commercial systems and tight industrial complexes and tight cash flow management and business practice. They're all an anathema to me. They're all offensive to the infinite degree. And I'm rambling on, but I think better when I ramble, because I don't like to think of anything as a lecture but as a story. And I think when you ramble, you tell a story that's full of dissociated facts. And you can associate them or not as you will. And that's the way I like to talk. That's the way I like to think. Well, I've monopolized a fair percentage of time, so I'm going to make perhaps one or two points more and then close out. We have something called upward mobility, and it's just a description of getting ahead faster and having more as you get ahead. Well, we have something that I've described now as downward manipulation. That's all the petty bureaucracies that say they know it better than you and can tell you how to do it. If they come up with an idea you can tie into, that's fine. But if they come up with threats or coercion or anything outside of the casual, spontaneous response that you may feel when you hear something new or different, then it's no good. So whether it's upward mobility or downward manipulation, I almost think that a static state and creative growth is a more important concept. A static state is setting rules and guidelines by which you manage yourself and you manage the land. That's what I mean by a static state. You have guidelines and you have fixed rules, and you develop a balance between yourself and what's on the land, what's under the land, and how you get the best from the land on the surface and how you get the best from under the land to balance what's going on the surface. Then you have something that might be downward manipulation. You have commission controls. Well, bureau management and commission controls may be the same. I watch quite a bit of live TV from Canada, and I realize the word commission there has a very powerful suggestion of importance, and bureaus and bureaucrats have the same inferential power and importance in America. Well, I believe in order to be real people, you have to divorce yourself from over-recognizing their importance. It doesn't mean that you should under-recognize or not recognize, but it's most important that you do not over-recognize to the point where you eclipse your own identity as a viable person doing his or her best creatively from day to day and allowing the growth pattern of your own activity to be more important than any kind of overlay or any kind of influential pressure that these outward, salaried, wage-earning personalities infer you should identify with. I think somewhere along the line we've got to get words like allotment and reservation and private and public and group, national, state, provincial, county, and borough, zones, districts, provinces, reordered into a pattern that makes us feel harmonious with all those geophysical political divisions. I don't know how it can be done. I don't know how it can be simplified. But all those words to me are just empty things that shade a little bit one way or another. They don't describe a farm lot or a garden plot or a fish pond or a hedgerow or an orchard or these are the only things I can see. I can't see what a reservation looks like. I can see what a group of trees or a flock of birds or a marsh I mean, only the things you can see matter. The things you can't see, they only matter a little bit. And you've got to sort out the words that matter from the words that don't matter, or they don't matter as much as they think they matter. And it's not easy. Well, there's no simple answer to any of it. But in closing, I would like to say that the most important distance in the world is the distance between your ears. It's your thinking capacity of how and what goes on and why it's important and how it should be addressed and how it should be limited in its influence on you and how you should limit yourself on your influence on others so that there's a balance. I think eventually when what I call the definable man comes to the front, there might be some sensibility on this planet yet. The definable man is pretty much lost in a maze right now of confusion, uncertainty, and meaninglessness. And until he gets defined, we're in deep trouble. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Griffith.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Griffith has given us a very broad perspective from which to examine ANCSA tonight, and I welcome other presentations from those present about the Claims Act and the issues it gives rise to.